Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. Rebuilding America's infrastructure, how much will it cost? Also, how much money does the United States have anyway? That and some other details about the economy. We have some weight loss tips for you. And 100 years ago today, Congress voted for the U.S. to enter World War I. We'll take a look at some of that history. That and a lot of other stories coming your way this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live. We're at 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. And if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that, at kpcgfm. You can email us comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau here today. And a lot happening in the news, and a lot of interesting stories to get to today on this Thursday edition. Are you ready for this?
Yes. Yeah, I had an interesting morning when I got to work. The internet wouldn't work for a while.
Mm-hmm.
So I realized how ineffective I am as an employee without internet.
That's the way it is today, though. No, seriously. If the internet goes away, everyone sort of just, what do you do?
Yeah.
Because most everything is based on the internet or a network of some kind. And there's funny commercials. AT&T had that funny one where they kept showing like how what happened to people several hours after not having the internet.
Right.
it is interesting. You do, particularly at work, you think, well, what can I do, depending on your job? Most jobs, though, a lot of them anyway, are internet-based, email-based, network-based. And so if you don't have the ability of that, you feel kind of like you don't have your tools.
Yeah. Basically, I had a few choices, but what I decided to do was eat a banana and read a book. So
it's not a bad morning. If you can, yeah, eat a banana, read a book. There's worse things you could do with your time. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show today, that's coming up here in a little bit on KPCG. Richard Palmer today. Make sure you listen for that. Also, stop and check out the headlines at thetrumpet.com. Top story today, Iran arming Bahraini militants. Bahraini is not a word that I say very often. This new evidence emerges that Tehran is infiltrating Bahrain. That's by Callum Wood. Also related to that, United States withdrawal threatens Bahrain and the King of the South. So you can stop and check out those headlines at thetrumpet.com. Do you say that? Bahrain?
Bahrain. Bahrain, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, I put the emphasis on the ba. Or else it sounds like I'm saying brain.
Yeah. It's always interesting. Any sort of international name or place, you hear a lot of different ways of it being said. The one that always surprised me a little bit was Hosni Mubarak. I thought that was kind of standard.
Right.
But then when he was in the news a few years ago more with the Arab Spring, I heard network people call him all sorts of things. Mubarak, Mubarak. There was all these different. I thought we were all agreed that it was Mubarak. But I heard all kinds of things.
Yeah, it's amazing. Each news network has its own enunciation guide. And it's funny, in my geography class, we just finished going through Africa, and now we're going into Asia. And of course, those are the sections with all the names no one can pronounce, including me. So it's just funny in class. We're all trying to figure out how to say these words, and each student has their own way of saying it, and it just gets pretty funny sometimes.
Yeah, different pronunciations. Here's an interesting note, a health note for you. This is from the Daily Mail. Older people, they say, according to a new study, need as much sleep as those who are younger, but they don't usually get it. And that has been something that I have heard over the years, that the older you get, you don't need as much sleep as when you're younger. But they're finding out anyway that they think that older people need just about the same amount. I don't think we're talking like 12-hour teenage marathon sleeps, but 7.5 to 9 hours, that's kind of the standard thought. Older people appear to need less sleep because they don't become as exhausted. but a new review has found they may have adjusted to a life without proper rest. So in other words, they need it, but they haven't gotten it for so long. They're just sort of used to it, but it's still doing some damage. They say that there's a mental price to pay for that, increased risk of dementia and other illnesses.
Yeah, that's a very compelling stat to get in the right amount of sleep every night. Especially when you're older, I guess, because most people don't have labor-intensive jobs, so you don't feel like you need the sleep. So you might stay up later reading or doing different things. I know, well, a lot of older people I know or friends with, they do go to bed very early, but they rise very early as well. So that's a really interesting study because I think just we're finding out more and more that having sleep solves a lot of problems.
Yeah. You've got a story later about they're trying to pay people to stay in bed for a long time for a study. We'll talk about that. Is it a dream job? Is it a nightmare job? You know, there's a balance. If you don't get enough sleep, we've all experienced that. Not as sharp usually the next day, a little bit delayed in some things. There are studies that say if you're really tired, it's as bad as if you were drunk in terms of driving.
Right.
And so sometimes people think they can push through, but it's really dangerous, especially if you're driving a vehicle or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's, of course, there are always moments when we're restless or tired, that kind of thing. But if it's a constant lifestyle, it can definitely wear and tear the body, but even your relationships with people. Usually when we're tired, we're short-tempered, don't have as much patience, we're foggy on things, and it just makes it more difficult to communicate. So it can cause lots of problems at work and in personal relationships. And if you look at light, now with electricity, it gets in the way. But when the sun goes down, people used to go to sleep, and usually you would have good 8-9 hours because it was dark and you couldn't really do anything else. So even nature kind of shows us that you should probably get to sleep.
Yeah, and that's a perfect tie-in to another little story that's interesting here as far as just proper weight and weight loss. People not following the normal ebb and flow of a day because, like you say, we can kick the lights on and stay up kind of as late as we want. This little write-up says, "Midnight snacks fight back." A nutritionist and a dietitian break down why snacking before bed is the worst thing we can do for our bellies. Probably not news to anybody, but it's easy enough to kind of snack later at night. They say, why do we get hungry at night? Well, first of all, I don't know. Do people actually get hungry at night? I don't think I really get hungry. I think I just kind of want to eat something. What about you?
Sometimes I'm definitely hungry before I go to bed. When I wake up, I don't really think about that. I think most of the times I'm thirsty, but I'm not really hungry.
Hmm. They say historically our bodies are used to waking up at dawn and becoming tired at sunset, to some extent, I suppose. They say since that's not usually possible this day and age when we're juggling work and family and social life, we reach for the snack drawer late in the day to keep our energy levels up or because it's just delicious. There's several reasons there. They say then a lot of times people skip breakfast because they ate so much the night before, only to come home and binge eat once again. So it's a bad cycle. They say late night food is usually junk food. That's true. Very rarely do you kick the kitchen door down for some carrots. It's yes. Usually something else.
Yeah, that statement is very, very true.
Very true. They say having a rough day is another reason for pre-bed cravings because we're stressed after work. We get home and reach for food that immediately hits the pleasure centers of the brain. Foods high in sugar, typically. In, of course, a lot of carbs are a sugar type substance, even if it's not sweet. They say not only does food in high in sugar oftentimes increase our cravings, and thus our caloric intake, it also can lead to serious health complications like type 2 diabetes. There's been a lot of reports about that. And they say why late-night snacking makes us fatter. They're not pulling any punches here. Less slim? They say our gastrointestinal tract and the pancreatic and digestive enzymes our body produces are designed to digest food during the day when we're able to quickly burn them off by moving about, assuming we move in the day, I guess. Since our digestive processes shut down at night, calories that would normally have been burned off instead make a home in other places in our body, belly, etc. So avoiding the late night snacks is a good thing if you have the discipline to do it.
Yeah, that's some really good practical points. And I can attest to a lifetime of reveling in late night snacks and being a night hawk that it definitely doesn't help my health at all. In fact, I probably did everything possible to destroy it when I was younger. And it's due to the diligence of my wife that it's getting back on track. But it is hard to do because snack food is so cheap. And at the end of a long day, you want to reward yourself. You just want to have a nice time after dealing with stressful things. So like chips, sugar, even a beer or like a nightcap or anything like that. It's just nice to have before bed. Or even doing things on your phone, watching TV. Those are kind of things we do in the evening. But those are all the things you shouldn't do before going to bed.
It's a bad cycle sometimes.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. I think late night snacking does affect several million of us. This is an interesting story and sort of a warning to parents and maybe adults too, but parents especially because of your kids. The Apple company bails out a family after an 11-year-old goes on a $7,500 in-app purchase spending spree. A lot of times, kids are interested in games, and very often they're free. But as you play the game, they say, you need this other thing. You need more power or whatever they're trying to. And so I've had that happen a time or two where I've gotten something for the kids, and they're like, oh, all we got to do is push this button. I said, well, hey, let me look at that real quick. They want to charge you. They're going to charge you for that. So this 11-year-old guy, he was doing that, and he spent $7,500, and the parents didn't know. They knew he was spending a little bit, but they had no idea, and he spent it fast.
Yeah, that's impressive in a disturbing way, especially since little games like that, usually it's a dollar or two at a time or even less.
Right.
So $7,500, I mean, he must have played the game six times and gone to the expansion packs and all that stuff because that's just a lot of money.
Yeah, this is from the UK. And the boy's father's credit card was linked to the account, and so he spent that $7,500 on in-game microtransactions through iTunes. They're like 99 cents, give or take. I mean, he may have gotten some that were a little more expensive, but he had a total of 50 separate in-app purchases made. So obviously, some were quite expensive, and got up to that $7,500 bill. And they were used to him getting a few 99-cent ones, but then obviously it increased. The father explained how quickly the money was spent, saying it took 5 minutes to spend 700 British pounds. 5 minutes? Wow. And another 30 minutes to spend 1,100 British pounds. He was allowed to use the iPad at the weekend, and the total amount was spent over the course of 2 weeks. And the boy's mother said she was unaware individual in-app purchases could cost so much. Her son told her the game was so good he couldn't stop and thought he only pressed the button a few times, 50 times, $7,500. But Apple's going to help him out in this case. So there are ways that you can put safeguards on those things. You can find out more information about that a lot of places, but that's a good idea to not have things like that linked to your credit cards and so forth, because the kids can spend it really quick.
Yeah, kids like button mashing. And whenever I see a video of a baby just pounding an iPad or a phone all and the icons, and you see all these screens going everywhere, or even animals, when they're doing that, it makes me nervous because you don't know what buttons are hitting, and it could be spending your money or doing other destructive things. So yeah, it's just amazing how even outside of what the kid did for fun, that at your fingertips, the consumer market is that available just in a few clicks of a button.
Yeah, it's really a real temptation. I mean, even online shopping, because if you think about having to get up, get in the car, drive to the store, let's say you have cash in your pocket to go buy an item, it's a little bit of work, But just sitting there and looking at things and hitting buttons and buttons and buttons is so easy to do, and it's easy to get in trouble with that sort of thing. So you do have to be careful with video games or anything online. It's so easy to spend money really quickly. And of course, then it's easy to have your information taken too, which is because our information's out there on the internet. And it seems like those stories come up every couple of months. You know, some major company gets hacked and they steal all the credit card information. I get a new credit card, you know, the same credit card, but just a different number probably, 2 to 3 times a year because somebody hacked it or stole it.
Right.
The bank's pretty good about getting on top of it, thankfully, but just seems to be the way it is.
Yeah, I think the best way to protect yourself is to have minimal connection to your credit card online. I mean, some things are the practical ways in which we pay for bills and all other stuff, but I think the people who are most vulnerable and experience it the most are just have their credit card everywhere. And sometimes you get on a app or on a website that isn't that secure, and it's really easy for hackers to take it.
Better a credit card than a debit card.
Yes.
Because you can't get that back. But credit card, you can fight the charges. And sometimes they'll help you out. So that's a warning to people. $7,500 spent on in-app purchases. It's a lot of money. Hope the game was fun. He said he couldn't stop playing it. They didn't say what game it was.
Yeah.
I wish I knew.
He better have beat it if he spent $7,500 on it.
Yeah, did you win? You better have won the game for that. There's an interesting section in the latest edition of the April edition of Time magazine. It's their cover story, actually. They say, "Dear Washington, we need to rebuild. Can you get your act together?" And they're talking about rebuilding the infrastructure of the United States. And that is something that needs to be done. I mean, we've all experienced it. You drive on some bridges and some roads and so forth, and you think, this could use an upgrade. And there's all sorts of situations, you know, water systems, electrical grids, oh boy, all kinds of things. So it's a really interesting write-up, and they've got some numbers that I thought the listeners would find interesting, and talks about what they think, how much money they think, how much we currently have to fund some of these projects, and then how much short we are. Electricity, they say current funding is $757 billion. They need another $177 billion. That's how short we are on infrastructure upgrades.
Yeah, so we have about 3/4. But, I mean, it might sound pretty good. We have 3/4, but raising over $100 billion, that's probably pretty hard to do, especially with the military budget is probably what cuts into all these different things.
Water and wastewater, current funding is $45 billion. Projected need $105 billion. You start adding all these up, and it gets going pretty quick. There's a story here recently, locally. Tulsa had a problem with their water. So it didn't taste right. And the water purification company, whatever you call them, the waterworks, they said it was okay, but it just was going to taste bad for a while because of some chemical they were putting in it. And you know, you always get a little worried about that stuff. I never liked the fact that when I drive by a water treatment center, it's the worst smelling place. That makes me nervous.
Yeah. Water purification is interesting because the process in which it's done is pretty messy, and you expect it to be the cleanest facility in the country because, it's potable water. It's what gives us what we cook with, what we drink with, everything. But most of the time, it's running through old pipes, pretty dirty facilities, old archaic facilities, and they're not that protected either. They're just sitting. I mean, of course they have security, but it's pretty minimal. Anyone could just kind of walk into there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Roads and bridges. They say current funding in the United States for the infrastructure for roads and bridges $941 billion. Projected need is $1.1 trillion. That I guess that would probably be the first thing we all think of because we drive on them and we notice if a road's not great. But then some of them are unsafe as well, bridges and overpasses. I mean, you look at the infrastructure of the U.S. and it's, it's been decades since it was really, Eisenhower or was it, I forget, Hoover?
It would have been between like the 30s and the 60s.
Yeah.
That's when all that was built.
They were doing a lot of that stuff, so.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is still from that time. Here's one that I didn't think of at all. Ports and shipping. The current funding is $22 billion. They need $15 billion. So I think over that 22, if I read those numbers correctly. But that's important. But since I guess we don't live near a shipping area here in Oklahoma, I don't think too much about it.
Right. I mean, that's huge since the East Coast, West Coast, they're the two big trading hubs. And the problem is if the American government or other private companies don't fund shipping, then big prop companies from China and other places come in, build the facilities for you, run the facilities until basically you don't even control your own trade anymore because these foreign countries come and fund them. And they basically own the goods that are being traded into your country.
They go on here. This is Time Magazine. They have a blueprint anyway that they've come up with for what the U.S. needs as far as infrastructure. They say we need to modernize the skies, replacing technology dating from the 1940s. So if you've been to some airports, you know that they've been there for a while.
Yeah.
And they could use a bit of an upgrade. Our airports aren't what they used to be. I mean, we used to be the best in the world, and now I don't think we're anywhere close to that.
Yeah, it's traveling internationally. I've always been more impressed by those airports than the ones I find in North America. So there are some exceptions to that, but because America built them first, we're at a big disadvantage because the newer they are, usually the better they are.
If you think about building a new airport, I mean, that's a lot of work, and you'd have to reroute your flight. I mean, it's a lot to change. Another thing they say here they want to do is make better batteries. I suppose that would be a good idea if you could do it. A safer and a smarter grid. They're worried about the threat of cyber attack on the electrical grid. It costs money when there are problems. Power interrupted, they say. A snapshot of nearly 4,000 blackouts recorded in the U.S. last year. We had 4,000 nearly blackouts. Number of affected Americans was 17.9 million. Outages caused by weather or trees, that was 1 in 3 people in the U.S. affected by that. And it was $150 billion of damage to the economy. So it's interesting when you have, whether it be a storm or another reason for a blackout or any of these things, you know, they're in the news for a day or two and they move on, but the cost is quite substantial. In this case, it was $150 billion that we don't have, by the way.
Yeah. Well, I guess that ties in with kind of with what we said at the start. No power, no internet. No way of communicating and getting business done or different things like that. I assume that's probably where most of the damage is in losing business costs, but also, I mean, the rebuilding entire electrical lines through cities and across vast distances from tornadoes and hurricanes and earthquakes, all those things. I mean, that's a huge undertaking, and most of the time it's done quickly and maybe not the best way.
Another thing they need to work on, they say, is fixing outmoded locks and dams to unclog the water highway. And we're talking about Ohio River, Mississippi, southern Illinois, those areas, Tennessee, the inner highway of the U.S. as far as water goes. And they give one example of lock and dam number 52. That's one of 239 in the U.S. that are critical. And they say 14% of all domestic freight per year passes through. The system, though, is aging. And the example of that one particular one, they say nowhere is the problem starker than Lock 52, through which 90 million tons of cargo worth some 10 billion passes annually. Crumbling concrete, rusted metal, and outmoded design means that 52, which was finished in 1928, and nearly... nearby Lock and Dam 53 opened a year later, now have average delays of 15 to 20 hours. I mean, you think about when that was built back in 1928 and 1929, and we're still using that today. probably needs to be updated, but again, where's the money going to come from?
Yeah, and how do you stop that flow of traffic to build a dam? I mean, you have to reroute $10 billion worth of shipping for that. I mean, that's... And where do those ships go if they're not on the major rivers? There's nowhere for them to go. So it's a problem that would involve not only the cost but in a loss of money to companies and to the U.S. until it's fixed, and then they can hopefully make back the losses later.
Another thing they want to upgrade is the internet, which of course is new, but a newer thing. But one quarter of the nation does not have broadband. It's interesting. You know, I guess we've all been maybe in some remote locations that didn't have broadband, but I don't know. You just kind of expect everybody to have it, but they don't. So they want to improve that too. All sorts of ideas that they're working on, including the waterworks that was mentioned before and so forth. There's one here. They have some people that are, I guess, successful, and they asked them their opinion. What would you build? And I thought this one was interesting. A local T. Boone Pickens. I think people know him. He says, we have to fundamentally rethink how we look at transportation in this country, and a key governmental objective should be the implementation of programs and policies that advance the use of domestic natural gas in place of foreign oil in our heavy-duty truck arena. Natural gas is cleaner, it's cheaper, and it's ours. He wants more natural gas.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea, especially since it... it would help produce jobs inside of America, have American companies, American capital, and it would also cut back on our competitors. I think Russia's the biggest exporter of natural gas in the world, so I think it would help our economy internationally as well if that was done on a pretty big scale across the U.S.
And there's just more and more and more. We don't probably have time to get into all of it, but they're talking about the trains. There's problems with the trains. They're relying on things from years and years ago. All sorts of issues, even just the rising sea and the coasts. They have to work on that. The bridges. There's really not an area of infrastructure that doesn't need to be improved. This is an interesting stat. It's surprising how many goods actually go by rail. The U.S. has 140,000 miles of freight railways. Annually, they carry 40 tons of goods per person. And goods travel more miles on trains than on any other mode. Rail takes 40%, truck 29%, pipeline 20%, water 12%, and air 1%. I tend to think that the trains don't do quite as much as they used to, but that's the most, 40%.
Yeah, I guess... growing up in the, in the plains of Canada, like what's called in Saskatchewan, the breadbasket of Canada, where a lot of wheat fields and that kind of thing, even potash and other minerals, because it's so flat, the only thing you see are railway stations. The big silos were built riverside railway tracks where they dump the grain into the cars and they move on. Most of them are just are old and they don't use them anymore. But just growing up, you kind of get a sense of rail is how all those things are moved, the food, the minerals, and that sort of thing, the oil and natural gas. And so I think, especially with America and Canada, they're so big, you have to cover so much land. Rail is still cheaper, and it crosses the flyover states where all the food and those kind of things are located. So always be popular because air is more expensive and all that sort of thing. But if you travel through those areas, most of the distinguishing landmarks are railway stops.
Yeah. Then it all looks depressed as well.
Yes.
Those don't look like thriving areas. I've never met somebody that's a train engineer. And I'd like to find out what that job's like. I don't know anything about it. I'd be very interested to know what do you do?
Right.
Do you drive it? Do you? You know, I'm sure I'm very ignorant in that, obviously, but I'm just very interested in it because, the only thing I've ever seen is movies or whatever from years ago where they're doing whatever they do on the train or yelling all aboard, things like that. But how does it work? That's an interesting thing to me. And apparently it's still a thriving job, but I've never heard anybody say I want to work, for the railway.
Right. Yeah, the only ones I know are miniature train engineers.
Right. Those aren't carrying a lot of goods.
Yeah, I see that when I lived in Calgary, I saw them, ones who operate the subway in the city, but that's a little different. But I've never met a real and full-fledged train engineer.
Train engineer, yeah. When I think of trains, I think of hobos and, just the sort of romanticized version of the rail life. So obviously there's a lot that has to be done. And I mean, in one way it would create jobs to do it, but then you got to fund it. I mean, somebody's got to pay for it. And, how much money does America have anyway? That's a good question. Obviously there's a lot of debt, but we're not focusing on that right now. America's piggy bank. How much liquid cash does the government actually have at any one time? And who's in charge of the checkbook? It's not me. Liquid assets. It says, while amounts go up and down depending on the value of the markets, the U.S. generally has around $14 billion in liquid cash on hand at any given date. This is the amount deemed necessary to run basic day-to-day operations. It's essentially the government's daily allowance. $14 bucks.
That seems low to me, especially in contrast to the debt. And I mean, when the budget comes out, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars going to this and going to that. And it makes sense, but it still seems low, especially if there's an emergency or something like that.
Bonding exercise. The total amount we normally have in the bank outside of ready cash averages around $200 billion. The lowest it's been recently is $74 billion. That was back in 2011, shortly after the recession. The rest of the money is made up of bonds, which is where a person buys U.S. currency as an investment. It's currently the safest and most secure currency in the world, which is, I guess, still true. And almost always likely to increase in value. That's an optimistic viewpoint. The majority of these bonds are owned by foreign countries, mostly China at present. So there's that cash too, but it's, well, it doesn't necessarily mean it'll always be there, I guess.
Yeah, they can cash in their bonds anytime they want. That would be a big problem because that, $74 billion or $200 billion and the $42 billion is not going to cover that.
No, we don't have it, but we could put a little something on it for you. The person in charge of all this cash is technically the Secretary of the Treasury, but it's really carried out by the Undersecretary of Domestic Finance. They say picture the former as the CEO of a bank, while the latter is a cross between CFO and loan officer. They oversee a staff who keeps careful track of the checks that go out, like the one you get for your tax rebate, hopefully, and whether they've been cashed or not. It's your bank's balance sheet, only mind-boggling vast in scale. So they're keeping an eye on all the checks that come and go, supposedly. But you always hear about some odd things occurring there. It's a lot of money to keep tabs on.
Yeah, to me, that would be a frustrating, complicated job, keeping track of all those numbers all the time and always fluctuating and all those sorts of things you need to keep mental tabs on every day. But someone has to do it, and it must just be amazing to step back for those employees and look at the amount of money being spent and the amount of money coming in and all those different figures.
All done with an abacus. And those guys that wear the green hats and the armbands.
Right.
From the old West. Yeah. I never could figure out why they wear the green hat. Like, what the point? Do you know what that is?
No. Maybe it's just something traditional and came from like England or something.
It's a visor. It's like a green visor. And they
right.
They are always wearing it at the bank. Yeah. I'm not sure why.
I have no idea. Maybe okay. Just the green, because money is green. It makes the people think of prosperity when they look at them. I have no idea.
Yeah, I don't know. Somebody will know that, but I don't know. you can email us that at comments@kpcg.fm. We'd be happy to know. Rather than being held in a regular bank, most of the $14 billion mentioned earlier is held by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. This is almost all in the form of bills, Benjamins. The head of the bank has constant access to the account, a bit like the banking app on your phone. Only it can measure the balance millisecond to millisecond. So that money is always coming and going. Where does all the money go, they say, from the $4.5 trillion the government collects in taxes each year? They say, well, America has bills, lots of bills, from federal employee paychecks to defense spending to rent. The federal government is the largest single leaseholder in the country. So there's a lot to spend. And then as we looked at infrastructure, the bills go forever. The cash runs out.
Yeah. And that job, you can never settle finish paying off the mortgage, any of those types of things, because you always have to pay for someone or for something. And plans change every 4 years, 8 years in the government too. So that completely changes where the money's going. So it's always fluctuating, and it must be amazing to see those numbers going up and down all the time. Just a constant flow of money.
Yeah. It's really, really something. But like it says, there's a lot of bills to be paid. lots of debt too that's not being talked about in some of these write-ups as much. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. We're online at kpcg.fm. And we have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. You can follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm, and you can email us comments at kpcg.fm. I'm Dwight Falk, and Abraham Blondeau is here today. And before we get into your story here, Abraham, just related to money, I was telling you before we came on the air, there's a lady, I think in California, who is charged with murder, pretty serious crime. They posted her bail at $35 million because they always give people a huge amount, so you usually won't pay. This lady posted it.
Right.
She had wealthy relatives. They actually put up $35 million for her to get out. So they had a lot of money to work with there.
Yeah, I hope she gives them a fruit basket or something in consolation. But yeah, that's a huge amount of money. And most people, I mean, bail is usually $100,000 or something like that. But $35 million, we'll see if she goes to trial or I don't know exactly what will happen there.
Yeah, is really, I think they set those really high, particularly on some serious cases, because they figure, well, they'll never get out. But then sometimes somebody shows up with the money. I don't know. You write a big check, I guess.
Yeah.
Come with bags of gold. $35 million.
Gold Ooh. Flakes.
Gold flakes.
Yeah.
A giant gold coin from Germany. This is an interesting story you've got. This is from Counsel and Heal, Science and Tech. Get paid to stay in bed for 60 days? This is a study. What are they studying? How much are they going to pay you?
Yeah, this is researchers in France at the French Institute of Space and Medicine and Physiology. They're looking for 60 good men, 60 good women, volunteers who are willing to stay in bed for 60 days. And they're studying microgravity. So basically, astronauts, when they're in space, weightlessness and kind of the effects of, I guess, weightlessness is similar to just staying in bed all the time. It has a similar effects on the body. So they want people who can stay in bed for 60 days, and they're paying them 16,000 euros, which is close to probably 18,000 US dollars, something like that,
wow.
Maybe more. So for 2 months, if you stay in bed, you can get paid $18,000.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think it would be horrible. You know how you feel if you stay in bed too long. You don't feel great. I imagine your body would sort of calibrate. I guess the only thing I could think of was being like sick. I've had times where I've been sick and I kind of mostly stayed in bed for, I don't know what the most would have been, 3 days maybe?
Right.
Something like that. But you get to the point where you're sick anyway, but then you feel kind of sick because you've been in bed the whole time. I can't imagine what 60 days would do. I think it would. And then how would you recover once you started to get up again? I mean, like you cannot get out of bed. They're saying you just gotta, you can't, like, you have to lay down or?
Well, they have certain rules with this. So these people, they're in bed. Basically, you have to be bedridden while you eat, sleep, wash up, all that stuff. And the requirement is they are required to have at least one shoulder in contact with the bed or the frame at all times. So
okay.
You can like get out of bed, but you have to one shoulder has to be in contact.
They basically want you laying down.
Yes,
because even if you got like let's say you got out of the bed and you just kind of walked around it with your shoulder, you'd still be stooped over.
Yeah.
So they're keeping you sort of in that state. I mean, I guess you could. Boy, I'm trying to think of, like what exercises you could do, but you'd be limited.
Yeah,
how do they know if you move your shoulder? The buzzer goes off and you made it 58 days and then your shoulder lost contact. No money for you.
Well, I think they're going to observe them all, like day to day, hour to hour. I don't know exactly how they're going to do that. But when I read that, it made me just think of these ridiculous scenes of people running down the street with a bed strapped to their shoulder and different things like that. People, because I remember... When I was sick pretty bad once and I was in bed for about 2 days straight, besides getting up and going to the bathroom, all that sort of stuff. And you get really restless and angsty that you want to just walk around, go outside, go play sports, whatever you want to do. So 60 days where you're perfectly healthy. I mean, I imagine they can go on the internet, watch movies, they have food brought to them, all that stuff. But still, I think it would just destroy your willpower or unless you have the will to get that $18,000, but it would just destroy your motivation and just everything. It'd just be difficult. But the reason for this is they're trying to see how astronauts, if they're in space for an exposed amount of time, how it affects their bodies, but then also how it, specifically the bones and the muscles, how they get weakened. But what you can do to help them, like how do you combat that when they're in that state all the time?
Yeah, they have studies, I think probably every year at universities that I've read about. The ones I've read about have been sleep deprivation ones. They want to see what happens. And so same sort of thing. You get paid whatever to stay up. I don't know for how long. But I have, what I've read about them is that some people can do it and then just kind of go back to a normal life. Some people never really recover from it if they stayed up too long. Which surprised me when I read it because I thought, well, you just get tired. I didn't realize how much it would affect your body. But some people just really don't come back from that. And so I wonder if it's going to be similar with this, where some people could kind of do it and then bounce back and others really can't.
Yeah, it's an interesting choice. They're pretty much, they have specific requirements to apply for this. So if you want to volunteer, you should be a male, I guess only males, between the ages 20 to 45, have to be a non-smoker, and in great shape without any illnesses at the time when you would start. You would also have to have a body mass index of 22 to 27 and be reasonably active in sports. So they want them to be pretty active, healthy people. And I think a lot of people are going to quit just because they just can't stand it. And I think a lot of them are going to be set back several years in their physical ability by doing something like this.
60 days is a long time. You think about, you know, first day, maybe all right, second, third, fourth. But eventually, I mean, boy, you'd be looking at that calendar like, come on.
Yeah.
Oh, I can't imagine that. And then the mental toll it would take too, knowing you can't get up. That you know, it's one of those things if you just read it in passing and, oh, they're going to get paid to stay in bed, you know, that sounds fun. But 60 days, I think it would be torturous.
Yeah, well, especially I think the idea you can't do something that automatically inspires in humans to, oh, I need to do that. So the fact that you have to stay in bed and you have to keep a shoulder there. You can't stand up in bed. You can't do push-ups or sit-ups in bed, I would imagine. Anything like that where you kind of can cheat a little bit. I don't know. It has a good intentions, I guess, just to help astronauts figure out how to be more healthy in space. But it's just interesting to see how many people sign up for this and how well they do and how many people stay on till the end for 60 days.
Shouldn't the astronauts do it? That part of their astronaut training?
But then they couldn't probably be an astronaut afterwards.
We've completely destroyed your body, but yeah. Yeah, well, it'll be interesting to see who'll do it. I'm sure there'll be some. I mean, that's a fair amount of money.
Yeah.
But the toll will be very interesting to see. I imagine the younger the person, the more they could recover.
Yeah.
The older you are, probably be harder. But that'll be interesting. That's from Counsel and Heal Science and Tech. Get paid to stay in bed for 60 days. No thanks. I'll pass on that. You got a historical note for us today here, Abraham, as well. On this day, 100 years ago, Congress voted for America to enter World War I. That's something that I would assume will never happen again. Not the fact that there won't be more wars, but it doesn't seem like the U.S. has any interest in being involved.
Right. Yeah. This is a pretty climactic moment because America as a nation had never been involved in a European war where we sent American soldiers to go fight in a foreign country outside of the continent. So this was a really big moment that way. Many historians believe it was America's entry into World War I is what signaled to the world that America was a great power, because they were coming out of their self-induced reclusive isolationist behavior to become a world player influencing other countries. And so on this day, Woodrow Wilson asked Congress to vote on going to war with Germany. And they did. And this is after a series. The main reason that caused America's entry Well, I think it was two major things, and most historians will attest to this. First one is you have a lot of people connected to Europe in America. most Americans are European. Excuse me, are from European descent, and so there's a lot of family ties and cultural ties there. And the other side is during World War One, Germany went on unrestricted U-boat warfare, much like they did in World War Two, just to try to defeat the British Navy and the shipping and everything coming from the U.S. And so with that, Germany started sinking neutral ships, which were American ships. And after continued protests from President Wilson, eventually he had to go to war because American sailors were dying, American citizens were being killed. And so eventually when push came to shove, Wilson went to Congress and they declared war on Germany.
And, you know, it's really an interesting thing as well because we had quite a few people from Europe, obviously, here in the U.S. that had moved not much before then to the United States, maybe a generation or so, or maybe even those people themselves. So it is kind of interesting because you're fighting the nations you came from. And I've heard stories about how that was a difficult thing for some people because it's not like they were removed from those countries in Europe for that long of a period of time. There is some kind of conflicting emotions about getting into something like that.
Well, yeah, there were, especially in America, there's a large German population in America from Germany. And so, and in Canada as well. And during World War One, it did cause a lot of division because you have Anglophones, Francophones in North America who automatically are going to have antagonism towards Germans living in North America, even though they have nothing to do with the war. And even those who are sympathetic or unsympathetic would be sometimes have tough situations to live with because of their ancestry. And so it is an interesting situation with America, a nation of immigrants, where even if you want to be an isolationist, you're not really, because all your links are to the outside world anyhow. An American is an immigrant at some point in history. So it is just an interesting thing to think about. But also, too, I think with America, America was still recovering from the Civil War. The Civil War only happened 40 years prior. And so that's less than a generation before. And so you still had families recovering from that war, fought on American soil. And I think we think the Civil War is something of ancient history. At least I do. I think it's older than it actually was. But it happened only 40 years before World War One, and so you had families sending all the doughboys who went over World War One. A lot of their fathers fought in the Civil War. Their grandfathers fought in the Civil War.
Yeah, it is interesting when you think about that time period. It's not that far between the two. And that's kind of the way it's been historically, especially in modern times. Maybe all history. If you really look at it, every generation kind of has their war that comes up that they have to go face. We haven't had that for a while. I mean, I suppose you could say Iraq, and a lot of people have gone to Iraq and Afghanistan. It's really impacted some, but as far as the overall population, it hasn't affected the big percentages like it has in these other battles, other wars.
Yeah, and World War One is also very different in the sense of who went over the fight. So in most of the other wars, American War of Independence, War of 1812, Civil War, they were citizen soldiers. They volunteered to fight. World War One was the first time conscription was used. Civil War, you could say that, but it's different circumstances. You're fighting within America. World War One was conscription to go fight in a foreign country. And that changes the outlook of the army. And in a book called American Soldiers by Peter S. Kinsvater, he goes through and documents some of that history. And he makes some really interesting points we can tend to think back on World War One with romanticism, especially the men who went over, that they were patriotic, that they were zealous to fight and all that, which is true in most cases. But it was the first conscription war, and a lot of the conscripts didn't want to fight. They would much rather stay at home with their wives, their families, and their farms, their jobs, instead of going to fight. And so it's the first instance where, like I think we saw in Vietnam, except World War One generation was much more noble about, I think, where you have that reluctance to fight. And Woodrow Wilson, the president, won the re-election just a couple years before 1917 on the platform of peace. He was anti-war. He promised not to go into a European war. But eventually, it wasn't really his choice anymore. So a lot of the American population was definitely against going to war. And so when we think of those soldiers who went over, they were conscripts. They weren't professional soldiers like the ones who fought in Iraq and Afghanistan in our times. The men who fought in those wars wanted to be there. They've been trained for years how to fight. In World War One, the boys that went over, some of them who went to the front, they were taught how to load and fire a rifle the day before they went into combat. So we're not talking about professional soldiers as we know of the American Army today. That generation, they were a bunch of amateurs fighting for their country, and sometimes because they were forced to because of conscription. But as Peter Kinsvater brings out, what was really unique is that no matter where they came from, they did bond with each other. And that's kind of what got them through the war, no matter if they were ideological crusaders, as he calls them, or conscripts. They relied on each other to get through the war and to learn how to fight. And I think that's an interesting point to take away from that, is that we can get divisive about war and fighting for our country. But in the end, it became a unifying force.
Yeah, can you imagine that? We probably all have been thrust into a situation where we weren't really prepared for it, but something of that magnitude, you know, where your life's on the line and you're just learning how to fire a rifle the day before, let alone how do you aim it? Now, granted, these guys would have been coming from a more rural background, so they might have had some of that, you know, outdoor activity anyway.
But
just, you know, the fact that when you go through military training, it prepares you as much as possible mentally for what is ahead of you. Probably never get totally prepared, but just to face the horrors of war just, you know, without any sort of real preparation, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's what, actually there's a great quote here in the book, just talking about that no matter how much you train, the environment of war is always a shock to anyone, because it's just, especially in World War One, where they would have seen twisted bodies and maimed people and like just mass destruction. And this is a great quote here. This is from a soldier himself saying this. In no other circumstances than the battlefield does man confront the knowledge that he is present and in that place for the purpose of suffering death at the hands of fellow man, and that he must kill if he is not to be killed himself. The battlefield, in short, is a place almost without mercy and utterly without pity, where the emotions which humanity cultivates and admires elsewhere, gentleness, compassion, tolerance, enmity, have neither room to operate nor place to exist. So not only do soldiers have to deal with the images of war, the sounds of war, most of the doughboys, when they went over there, they were just digging trenches for hours, trying to using a small little trench shovel, digging through the frozen soil of France. Didn't work well. They even used their hands, and their hands got bloody and blistered from just trying to get some kind of cover from German fire. That was their experience. It wasn't glorious or romantic. It was just hard work. But I think the bigger struggle for them is the emotional one of realizing all the morals and the ideals you had in America. When you go there, they're thrown out the window. And you have to be comfortable with killing other humans, or yourself will be killed and all your friends will be killed if you don't do the right thing. So it's I think that's the hardest part to accept out of the environment of war.
And then they're expected to become just normal citizens again when they go home.
Yes.
If they go home, which is, how do you do that? How do you unleash that other side of that, you know, what you'd have to become in war and then go home and be just regular again?
Yeah.
I don't know if that's even possible to flip that switch.
What's interesting is he did a lot of psychology studies, and they found that soldiers who fought in World War II and Korea adjusted better to civilian life because they could better justify their actions, mm-hmm. because they thought they were fighting against evil. World War One, a lot of people didn't see Prussia as evil, just as aggressive. And in Vietnam, people were completely opposed to the war on many grounds. So it's just interesting. People could deal with that environment better if they felt justified in fighting an evil opponent rather than one that their country is compelling them to fight.
Yeah. I guess it would be the same sort of mentality if you fought off a home invader versus you just attack somebody on the street.
Right.
It might be the same action, but there's a reason for it, so you'd probably handle it better.
Exactly.
Yeah, really, really interesting history there. 100 years ago today is when Congress voted to enter World War One. That's all the time we have for this edition of Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for spending some of your day with us. For myself, Dwight Falk and Abraham Blondeau, have a great rest of your Thursday, and we'll talk to you again tomorrow.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.